The name Richard Wurmbrand has become almost a household word for a living martyr in our day. He has been called the voice of the underground church. Christian leaders have called him the Iron Curtain Paul. This evangelical minister spent 14 years in communist imprisonment and torture in his homeland of Romania. During this time, he spent 3 years in solitary confinement. Can you imagine that? Seeing no one but his torturers. Twice he was released, and each time he returned and resumed his underground ministry in spite of the danger of imprisonment. Realizing the great danger of a third imprisonment, Christians in Norway negotiated with the communist authorities for his release from Romania. At that time, in 1964, the communist government had begun selling their political prisoners. The going price for a prisoner was $1,900. The price for Wurmbrand was $10,000. Two Christian organizations, the Norwegian Mission to the Jews and the Hebrew Christian Alliance, paid his ransom. Some years ago, it was our privilege to meet Reverend Richard and his wife Sabina Wurmbrand at a meeting in Alberta, Canada. The brother had to sit while he spoke, for his feet still suffered the effects of the torture. Oh, how our hearts burned within us as we listened to one whose love for Christ and his brethren had risen to heights we had never known possible. He was a true man of God, and we felt we could have washed his feet with our tears. Yet, this man of God would not have reached this spiritual stature had it not been for the challenge of his wife, Sabrina. At the very beginning of the persecution, when there was still opportunity to draw back and avoid going to prison, she challenged her husband, "Wipe the spittle off the face of Jesus." She let him know in no uncertain terms that she could never be proud of him if he compromised and refused to stand up for the Lord, no matter what happened to him. He gives her great honor for helping him to stand for Christ when the price for his family and himself was so high. By this time you may be wondering why I am telling you about this precious couple. Is not this book supposed to be about seeing the glory of God? I shall tell you why. Off and on for a week I heard this phrase, "the names of God in my spirit." Andrew Jukes has written a book by that name, which I have read several times. With this word came the knowing that I was to write a book setting forth the names of God, which clearly portray his nature in all its many aspects. The majority of Christendom knows so little of the nature of God. When lies are told about his nature, they readily believe them. I was reluctant to hear this word. How could I portray his nature? That was too great a task to ask of me. At the supper table, Bill and I discussed it, and I prayed, "Lord, please confirm this to my heart if this is what you are asking of me." After supper, we sat together to pray. Immediately, a strong weeping travail came over me. I didn't know what it was about, but in my spirit was this clear word, "Wipe the spittle off the face of Jesus." When the travail lifted, it was very clear what the Lord wanted me to do. The Spirit of the Lord said, "I have justified you many times in the eyes of my people. Shall I not be justified? Not that I need to be justified and my righteousness proven, but my people need to know that I am a righteous judge and am not what they have imagined me to be. I do give thee this privilege of setting forth my nature as I have revealed it unto thee, and what my word testifies of me. I will be with thy words to help thee, and my name shall be cleansed from uncleanness in the minds of those who read and believe your words and listen to them." The first time the Lord began to show me what his glory was, I was yet a young Christian. If anyone had asked me then what the glory of God was, I probably would have answered, "Oh, it's some sort of bright aura like you see around the head of Christ in some pictures of him." I was reading in Exodus chapters 33 and 34 when I was arrested by what Moses said, "I beseech thee, show me thy glory." My spirit was instantly at attention. Now I was going to find out what God's glory actually was. God's answer to Moses was, I will make all my goodness pass before thee, and I will proclaim the name of the Lord before thee, and will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and will show mercy on whom I will show mercy. I was quite surprised at these words, for when Moses talked and asked to see his glory, God started telling him about his goodness and his nature, which is his name. Then God told him that he would have to stand upon a rock. And I put that with a capital R, wouldn't you? He'd have to stand upon a rock by him, and he would hide him in the cleft of the rock and cover him while he passed by. And that's in Jesus. For, said he, thou canst not see my face, for there shall no man see me and live. This rock represents Christ, who was that rock that followed them in the wilderness. Standing upon Christ, hidden in him, Moses could begin to know the glory of God that is his nature, his goodness, if you will. In that same way do we come to know him. For God, who commanded the light to shine out of darkness, hath shined in our hearts, to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. That's from 2 Corinthians 4 and 6. Further, no man hath seen God at any time. The only begotten Son, which is in the bosom of the Father, he hath declared him. From John 1:18. And the Lord descended in the cloud, and stood with him there, and proclaimed the name of the Lord. Did he proclaim all the names by which he has revealed himself to mankind? Why, not at all. He proclaimed Yahweh, Yahweh, El of compassion and favor, slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness and faithfulness, keeping loving kindness to 1,000 generations, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, though he leave not utterly unpunished, visiting the iniquity of fathers upon sons, and upon sons' sons, unto a third and unto a fourth generation. This is from Exodus 34, verses 6 and 7 from the Rotherham Bible. He proclaimed his nature. He testified of what he is in his nature. The words used here are compassion, loving kindness, and favor, and they all have to do with mercy and grace. The King James reads, the Lord God, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abundant in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, and that will by no means clear the guilty. These majestic words brought forth a startlingly new view of a supreme monarch, a king who would forgive law-breaking, trespass, and evil to anyone who seeks that forgiveness. He will not clear the guilty as long as they remain guilty. But they need not remain guilty before him, for his law provides a way to his mercy. This means that the guilty remain guilty until they are willing to meet God on the grounds of the mercy which he has provided for their forgiveness. The old covenant was a marvel in the earth at that time, for it provided mercy to all. There was never any law in any other nation like it for that very reason, for the law of Moses was a revelation of God himself. Even though Israel had committed idolatry and had worshipped the image of a beast, God still renewed his righteous laws unto them a second time and proclaimed aloud his nature unto Moses. The glory of his goodness was spoken forth in power. The Lord is merciful, gracious, long-suffering, and abundant in goodness, which means much mercy. The people, even as many today, did not understand or know God's nature, so they sinned in worshipping the vainglory of self in the place of God. In all the world there is no such cruel beast as that which is in the heart of every man and woman, self-love. They didn't know that man had been created to bear his glory and to represent him as he is, to testify the truth of what he is, and to love him with all his heart. and in order to do this we must have a mind to suffer. The day after the Lord impressed me to write this book and to tape this tape, all I could do was weep before the Lord. Finally, I asked him why I was weeping so, and he said, I wanted you to know the longing of my heart to be loved in my being, for what I am, for therein lies the ultimate peace and rest, to love and to become that which I am. I have purposed not to cease drawing my creation until all see me as I am in my being, and seeing desire to be in my image and likeness completely. Then shall my family bring satisfaction to me, even as my firstborn son, who took upon himself a body of flesh, and was fashioned as a man, to redeem man from death. This word reminded me of what Jacob Bohem had said, around 1612, when he received great illumination by the Spirit of God. He was shown that God stirred himself to produce creation. He was desirous of having children of his own kind. Creation was an act of the free will of God. God unfolded his eternal nature, and through his act of love or desire, he caused that which heretofore had been in him merely as spirit, as an image contained in a piece of wood before the artist has cut it out, to become substantial and corporeal. God longed after the visible substance of his similitude and image, and so he created man. Richard Wurmbrand tells of a Christian named Grikhu who was sentenced to be beaten to death in slow, repetitive beatings. The one who led his torture was a member of the Central Committee of the Communist Party called Rek. At a certain point, Rek would say, "You know, I am God. I have the power of life and death over you. The one who is in heaven cannot decide to keep you in life. Everything depends upon me. If I wish, you live. If I wish, you are killed. I am God." Brother Grikhu, in the face of horrible pain and mockery, gave this answer. "You don't know what a deep thing you have said. You are really a God. Every caterpillar is in reality a butterfly, if it develops rightly. You have not been created to be a torturer, a man who kills. You have been created to become a godlike being. Jesus told the Jews, 'Ye are gods.' The life of the Godhead is in your heart. Many persecutors like yourself, even the Apostle Paul, discovered that it is shameful for a man to commit atrocities. They can do much better things. They may become partakers of the divine nature. Believe me, Mr. Rek, your real calling is to be a god, godlike, not a torturer." At the time, Rek disregarded the words of his victim, but they worked in his heart until he understood that this was his real calling, and he had a change of heart and believed on the Lord. Isn't that marvelous? Through suffering, these believers learned the very nature of Christ, who sustained them in all of their trials. In solitary confinement, Wurmbrand tells us that he could not even concentrate sufficiently to say the Lord's Prayer. All he could say was, "Jesus, I love thee." One glorious day he got an answer from Jesus. "You love me? Now I will show you how I love you." At once I felt a flame in my heart, which burned like the coronal streamers of the sun. You know that halo of light that is round the sun? That's how it burned in his heart. The disciples on the way to Emmaus said that their hearts burned when Jesus spoke with them. So it was with me. I knew the love of the one who gave his life on the cross for us all. Such love cannot exclude the communists, however grave their sins. Communists have committed horrors, but many waters cannot quench love, neither can the floods drown it. Love is strong as death, jealousy is cruel as the grave. As the grave insists on having all, rich and poor, young and old, men of all races, saints and criminals, so love is all-embracing. Christ, the incarnate love, will never cease until he wins the communists, too. My friend Faith Williams often says to me, we need to have a mind to suffer. It is quite evident that our Western cultures do not encourage the idea that any good can come out of suffering, especially wrongfully. Few have a mind to suffer, to endure joyfully whatever the Lord sends to purify and perfect their hearts. This, I believe, is directly related to how they view the nature of God. If they see him as a good God, then all good comes from him, they reason. If something comes not to their liking, it must be from the devil. They have decided good is from God, bad is from the devil. This simplistic standard can raise many problems. When the Lord brings some situations into our life to child train us, to teach us obedience through the things that we suffer, what is our reaction? If that's God, then I don't want to have anything to do with him. I can't serve a God who would do that or ask that of me. And on their carnal judgment of what God's nature is like, they walk away to serve self.